We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. 50 years ago this spring, 450 Americans, black and white, put their lives on the line simply by getting on a bus. They knew that federal law protected their right to travel together, but they also knew they could be killed for trying to exercise that right. In this hour of Focus, we'll be looking back to the Freedom Riders and their contribution to the struggle for civil rights. We have two guests joining us. Raymond Arsenault is John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida, and he's authored a book about this subject, Freedom Riders 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice, published by the Oxford University Press. It's now a companion edition to a new documentary that will be airing on our public television station and many others as part of the series American Experience. Freedom Riders will be airing on WILL-TV on Monday, May 16th at 8 in the evening. So you can look for that. And of course, if you'd like to read the book, it's now available in paperback. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Also joining us is Thomas M. Armstrong. He was a Freedom Rider, the veteran of the early 60s civil rights movement in his native Mississippi. It was at the forefront of early protests led by black Southerners for voting rights and equal public accommodations. He's written about his experiences in his memoir, Autobiography of a Freedom Rider. I also want to mention, too, that following the show, we'll have a live chat about struggles with racism in East Central Illinois. This will be again at 11 o'clock Central Time, our time, and that'll be hosted on our new community engagement website, WillConnect. The number, if you'd like to join the conversation here this morning in this hour of Focus, is same as always, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email. So if you'd like to put your input there into the show that way, you can certainly do that. The address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And Professor Arsenault, hello.
Hello.
And thanks very much for joining us. And Thomas Armstrong, hello to you.
Oh, fine. How are you? Hello.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. Just as a way of starting out here, I think, Professor Arsenault, it's pretty clear that you feel that the contributions of the Freedom Riders perhaps were, shall we say, eclipsed a bit by events that happened a little later on in the civil rights movement. And your interest in writing the book and in talking about this is to put the spotlight once again on these folks who were involved in the Freedom Rides.
That's right. When I started my book 13 years ago, the general narrative of the Civil Rights Movement made mention of the Freedom Riders, but it didn't emphasize their contribution. It didn't emphasize the Freedom Rides as a pivotal moment in the Civil Rights Movement or in the history of American democracy, which I think it was. And it was, in part, I think, because the events of the mid-1960s, Freedom Summer and the March on Washington and the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965 were so dramatic and culminating that everything that came before appeared to be essentially part of the white noise, and it all got merged together, when in fact the specific contributions of the Freedom Riders were crucial to the development of the movement and the deep changes towards social justice and racial equality that occurred later in the 1960s.
Let me bring in Mr. Armstrong, because I think that, again, a lot of people would say that this event, this series of events, might well be seen as the first real victory in the civil rights struggle, or at least in that phase of the civil rights struggle. Maybe you can talk some more about why it is that you think this was important.
Well, I think the Freedom Riders is very important in that particular phase. It was somewhat the first great achievement. However, blacks in the South, and especially in Mississippi, had been working for decades, going about the business of trying to improve their lot, thereby participating in various voter registration campaigns. In fact, I did myself participated in those from latter part of 1958, under the tutelage of a young man named Mega Evers at that time, who was the Mississippi State Field Secretary for the NAACP. Blacks had been working for quite a while, even though, you know, many saw that the voter registration was an extremely long process. When the Freedom Riders came, it was more direct, and that's what made it stand out. Okay?
Well, perhaps you could talk some more about, and we can talk here about how it is that public transportation came to be a focus of action. But maybe, again, you, Mr. Armstrong, you can talk a little bit about, well, what would have been the experience of people, of black people, in riding buses or trains at the time that we're talking about, say, you know, the early 1960s?
As far as transportation was concerned, blacks could not ride at the front of the bus. If they were even in the rear of the bus, and the bus was full, and as whites boarded the bus, the blacks had to get up and give them their seats there. They could not walk comfortably down the bare sidewalks of the towns and cities in Mississippi when approaching whites. They had to get off the sidewalk. So there were a lot of things that restricted blacks from the normal, you might say, process of movement. And you could not get food at the various lunch counters in the transportation facilities. They just wouldn't feed you. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the things that was going on.
Yeah. Maybe I'll come back here to Professor Arsenault. You can help us have a little bit more context here, because this issue, access to public transportation, was something that had been identified as an issue for action really going back to the mid-1940s. And we can talk about the Supreme Court case that really forms the basis for the action. But perhaps also you can talk a little bit more about why, of all the various things that people would choose as their avenue for action, why it is that trains and buses might be something that people would pick.
Well, Jim Crow segregation in transit facilities had been a major aggravation going back to the 19th century. There had been streetcar boycotts, and it was something that people encountered, particularly working class people, as a example of public humiliation, time and again. You know, it was something to kind of reinforce their status as second-class citizens, and there had been great interest in this issue, again, going back to the late 19th century. In the 1940s, of course, it became at least conceivable that the Supreme Court would rule segregation in interstate facilities unconstitutional. The use of the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution gave the NAACP an opening, the possibility of sort of cracking the at least the surface of the whole Jim Crow system, and that's what Thurgood Marshall and other attorneys did in the 1940s, using the case of Irene Morgan, a young woman in Virginia who refused to give up her seat in July of 1944. Very similar to what Rosa Parks did 11 years later in Montgomery. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and she won in June of 1946. But the attorneys general and the white supremacist politicians in the South just ignored it. And with the NAACP, got very frustrated at the inability to enforce this constitutional decision. And they went on to other issues. But for black people, particularly in the South, this was not a forgotten issue. It was a daily humiliation, and of course it resurfaced with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 and 56, and then a second Supreme Court decision in December of 1960, Boynton versus Virginia. It extended the desegregation, at least in theory, in the terminals and the waiting rooms and the restrooms, sort of extending the Morgan decision of 1946, but cradle to grave segregation still was the rule. And so that's why the Freedom Riders had to do something desperate to get the attention of the Kennedy administration to get them to enforce their constitutional rights and to make these two Supreme Court decisions have some force in people's individual lives.
Yeah. That's, you know, people certainly know the name of Rosa Parks, and they know about what she did, and they know about the Montgomery bus boycott. I expect probably a lot of people do not know the name of Irene Morgan, and they have not heard about this big case, Morgan v. Virginia. And I wonder why it is you think maybe you wouldn't say Irene Morgan, they'd say, oh, yes, I know who that is.
Well, of course, the decision was essentially ignored, and the Interstate mm-hmm. Commerce Commission refused to enforce it, and the Eisenhower administration refused to enforce it. And when John Kennedy was elected in 1960, there was hope that there would be a new day in civil rights, but his early weeks in office were very disappointing. His focus was only on the Cold War, and when the James Farmer took over as the head of the Congress of Racial Equality in February of 1961, he had a stack of letters on his desk from people who had been intimidated or arrested and saying, we thought there had been these two Supreme Court decisions. How come they're still treating us as if cradle-to-grave segregation is the law of the land? And he decided to return to the idea of a freedom ride, which had actually been done back in 1947. The Journey of Reconciliation had gone through the Deep South, but it was the same week that Jackie Robinson desegregated Major League Baseball in April of 1947, and so the Freedom Ride didn't get a lot of media attention, and it was largely forgotten during the 1950s until Jim Farmer and his core staff revived it in April and May of 1961.
Our guest in this hour, pardon me, Mr. Armstrong, go ahead. Yes.
No, I'd just like to say also, approximately 5 years prior to the Borden ruling in 1960, there was a case called Sarah Keys versus Carolina Court Company that explicitly denounced the Plessy versus Ferguson case, which I guess you say validated the separate but equal status of travel. But the ICC, okay, had failed to enforce its own ruling, and therefore, as Professor Arsenault said, Jim Crow travel laws remain in force. So that's what I want to say about
that. And that really didn't change ultimately until Bobby Kennedy really put pressure on or directed the ICC to ban segregation in interstate bus travel.
Well, that was a twofold thing also. Bobby Kennedy definitely did put the pressure on him, but at the same time, there was a case coming out of Mississippi known as Broadwater versus Mississippi, which was had stated that separate but equal transportation facilities was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So that case was turned over to the ICC at approximately the same time that Bobby Kennedy decided to place that problem in the ICC's lap. So there was a lot of pressure on the Interstate Commerce Commission to outlaw segregation in transportation facilities.
Let me introduce the guest for this hour of focus. You just heard Thomas M. Armstrong. He's a veteran of the early 60s civil rights movement in his native Mississippi. He was a freedom rider, has written about it in his memoir, Autobiography of a Freedom Rider. Also joining us is Raymond Arsenault. He's a professor of Southern history at University of South Florida and author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961, and The Struggle for Racial Justice. It is a companion to a new series that will air on public television coming up very soon, and it's part of the American experience about the Freedom Rides. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone online here from New York, so they must certainly be listening online. We'll go there to our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having Mr. Arsenault and Mr. Armstrong on. My name is Natalie Bell, and I am a journalist here in New York. I have worked with Mr. Armstrong to write his memoir. And I wanted to say to the folks listening that, first, I certainly must give credit to Mr. Arsenault for connecting the dots and elevating the significance of the Freedom Rides within the civil rights movement, as showing the pivotal, crucial role that it played in the movement, in fact, getting off the ground in the early 60s. And I wanted to say, as someone who worked with Armstrong in detailing his personal story, a lot of people who came up during segregation don't even want to talk about it because it's a period of this nation's history that a lot of people of color don't want to particularly remember because it was a humiliating experience. And my own mother, who also grew up in Mississippi, in the same part of Mississippi that Mr. Armstrong grew up, never told me some of the things that I learned through the course of researching Mr. Armstrong's story. And so I wanted to point that out to the audience so that they would realize the significance of this story and the fact that many of the people who lived during this particular experience of segregation in the South are still a part of our society today.
Well, I certainly appreciate your call. I would give Mr. Armstrong the opportunity to comment on that, and perhaps you might want to talk about why it is that you feel that telling the story is so important.
Oh, telling the story, actually, examines the history of the civil rights movement itself. It tells about the advancement of the past 50 years and looks at the inequities that have gone on. In my book, in dealing with that particular matter, we're trying to get the young people to understand that this was a period that was definitely changed and made for the better by young people, not unlike the young people of today. So that's one of the things.
Sure. Well, Ms. Bell, I want to thank you very much. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to mention.
Yes, I just wanted to say a couple more things.
Sure.
That the reason that a lot of the people of color who lived in the South during this time, these are people who stayed in the South. You know, we often hear of the blacks who migrated north, and certainly there were hundreds of thousands who did, but then there were hundreds of thousands who stayed, and they consider themselves Southerners, the same as white Southerners, and it's certainly an important part of African-American history in this country, the South, the Southern tradition. And these were people who, as one gentleman put it in the film that's going to air on PBS that you referred to earlier, based on Mr. Arsenault's book, the way he put it was that there was a time in this country that black people lived in fear of white people. And that's hard to believe in this day and age. But it was the truth, and the younger generations, it seems that particular truth has been lost in our history. And it's so important that young people learn the story of the Freedom Riders, the dynamic foresight that they saw that change was possible at a time when most people did not think we would ever see racial integration during the time of the Freedom Rides.
Well, I appreciate, again, you giving us a call. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me, maybe this would be, again, a good opportunity for me to ask Professor Arsenault to talk a little bit more about who the Freedom Riders were, that is, as individuals, who they were, what their background was. We've talked a little bit about how now there were two important civil rights cases decided by the Supreme Court, where they said essentially that discrimination on interstate buses was unconstitutional, and in the terminals was unconstitutional. And then the Freedom Rides were organized by the Congress of Racial Equality in 1961 as a way of saying, all right, that's what the law says, but let's see what the reality is. So the people who participated, people like Mr. Armstrong, who were they? Where did they come from?
Well, the most striking thing about the Freedom Riders as a group, the hallmark of the Freedom Riders, was their diversity. The age range, for example, was 13 to 61. Most of them were young, of course. About a quarter were under the age of 20, and about half of them were in their 20s. Roughly half black, half southern, half northern. A quarter were women. And they came from all parts of the United States, and there were a number of international riders as well among the 436 riders. This is very important, I think, because there was an attempt during the spring and summer of 1961 to demonize the Freedom Riders as subversives. In the white press, particularly in Mississippi and Alabama, it was often argued that the Freedom Riders had been hatched. They had been planned in either Havana or Moscow. They were part of some sort of international communist conspiracy. And people really believed that. But as the summer progressed, it became increasingly difficult to sustain that demonization when many of the Freedom Riders became the boys and girls next door, when they became the profile of the Freedom Riders began to look like America. Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York, son-in-law was a Freedom Rider. There were rabbis and ministers and Episcopal priests and labor leaders and teachers and ordinary working-class people. And even though the public opinion polls still a majority tended to oppose the Freedom Riders' techniques of nonviolent direct action, they didn't like people disrupting the civic order, it became increasingly difficult to demonize them in the sense that they were somehow part of a lunatic fringe. And they, I think the thing that really holds them together is that in the Freedom Riders that I've talked to at length, is that they had something had happened in their life to put them outside of the box, to use that cliche, that they knew someone who had been a conscientious objector or who had been, in some cases, a member of a radical political party, or they had experiences in the Deep South, searing experiences with interracial violence that put them beyond the sort of normal experiences of most Americans. A number of the white Freedom Riders, for example, had contacts at historically black colleges. They had Quaker teachers or something that sparked a glint of an opening beyond the kind of mainstream understanding of the kind of complacency that most white Americans, at least, grew up in. And I think once the opening occurred, their commitment to the civil rights struggle became deep and lasting, and it opened up all kinds of possibilities for people dedicating themselves to the movement. I think that's the other thing that's so striking about the Freedom Riders, that they signed on for life. This became their life, and they were willing to die for this cause. This was no casual commitment on their part.
Well, let me turn again to Mr. Armstrong, because I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about that very point there. Yes, go ahead.
Even with all of that diversity from outside of the state of Mississippi, the Mississippi power structure at that particular time began a campaign in their defense, which said that all of the Freedom Riders happened to be outside agitators. A group of Mississippi people, especially students at Tougaloo College in Mississippi, decided that it was time for Mississippi to step up and begin their participation in their fight against segregation and join the Freedom Riders. And that's what we did in June of 1961. We got involved for a number of reasons. Some of those reasons was that we, as blacks in Mississippi, were tired of segregation. We were just tired of it, period. Okay? We were tired of the killings. As I said, we participated in voter registration throughout the South. And Mississippi, were killing people who participated in any type of movement that tried to advance the cause of blacks. So we were tired of all that, and we wanted to do something. And when the Freedom Riders came to Jackson, we were overjoyed to join them.
Can you talk a little bit about, everybody involved had to have known that they were putting themselves in a very dangerous situation. What were you told, or how was there an effort to prepare people for what they might face?
Well, you fail to understand. We were in danger every day. I was a resident of Mississippi, so we were in danger every day. We were putting our lives online every day. So it wasn't unusual. It wasn't something that we had to be told. We knew it. If you stepped outside of the boundaries set by segregation as a black person, anything could happen to you. We knew that. That's why it was it wasn't a common thing to participate in nonviolent sessions by members of the Young Mississippi group, because we knew what nonviolence was. Nonviolence was already a way of life to us. It wasn't a tactic.
I might interject here that Mr. Armstrong is absolutely right. It was such a crucial change in the nature of the Freedom Rides when local black Mississippians joined in large numbers. He was a member of the so-called Tougaloo Four, and they sort of broke the ice on this situation and didn't. It really prevented the white supremacists in Mississippi to continue to argue that the Freedom Rides represented outside agitation and nothing else, that Mississippi blacks were complacent and that they accepted the segregated Jim Crow way of life, and the whole myth of this began to crumble, and the mystique of Jim Crow, I think, began to crack. And so it was so important when the local Mississippi blacks got involved in the Freedom Rides, and they did it at an extraordinary risk. I mean, there was great fear, and a fear that was well founded in an incredible tradition of violence. There's a famous apocryphal story that came out of, not out of the Freedom Rides, but out of Freedom Summer in 1964, about a white student who had volunteered to go to Freedom Summer, to go to Mississippi, and he'd never been south, and he was scared to death, and he gets down in his dorm room the night before he's supposed to go to Mississippi, and he asks God to go with him to Mississippi. I mean, he asks him, please, God, give me some sort of sign that you'll go with me to Mississippi. And after five or six times, finally the voice comes out of the ceiling, I'll go as far as Memphis. And that story, I think, speaks volumes about the special ferocity of white supremacy and how it was maintained in Mississippi.
Yeah. This morning we're talking about the Freedom Riders. Our guests, historian Raymond Arsenault and Thomas Armstrong, a civil rights activist who was a Freedom Rider. We'll be talking more with both of them after a short break. This is Focus.
I'm David Teal from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We're here for 10 topics each week, and let me mention a couple just real quickly. In the second hour today, we'll talk about public employee unions. And our guests will be Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld and Craig Olson. They're both professors in the school of labor and employment relations at University of Illinois. On the program Wednesday in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with journalist Deborah Fallows about some of her experiences living in China and trying to learn Mandarin Chinese. She's written about this in her book, Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. Also then, to finish up the week in the 10 o'clock hour on Friday, we'll be talking with Adam Hochschild. To End All Wars is the topic of a new book that he's authored that's a history of the First World War. You can go to our website and get the schedule for the entire week. You can also catch up on some programs you might have missed first time around, and that address is will.illinois.edu. In this hour, we have two guests. Raymond Arsenault, he's professor of history at the University of South Florida. He's the author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. It's published by the Oxford University Press. It is the companion edition to a new documentary that will air on public television stations around the country in about 10 days or so, ours included. That's part of the American Experience series, and it's called Freedom Riders. You can see that program on WILL-TV on Monday, May 16th, 8 o'clock in the evening. Our second guest is Thomas Armstrong. He's a veteran of the early 60s civil rights movement in his native Mississippi and was a freedom rider. And he's written about this in his memoir, Autobiography of a Freedom Rider. Let me also mention we'll be doing a live chat right after the show, talking about struggles with racism in East Central Illinois. So after the program, you can head there to the site of the chat. And questions on the program here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And also, if folks would like to send in an email, you can certainly participate in the program that way, and the address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. We've talked about the fact that this was a very dangerous undertaking. People perhaps know about attacks on freedom riders. There was one very famous one where a mob attacked a bus and set it on fire. I'd like to hear from Mr. Armstrong. Tell me about pick some kind of experience that would really put across to people what it was like, that experience of being a freedom rider.
Oh, of course, I was not one of the original freedom riders on the bus that burned. We were at Tougaloo College as students at that particular time watching the event on television.
Mm-hmm.
And as the events unfolded, from Anniston all the way through to Jackson, Mississippi, we were glued to those TV sets. We still felt that something drastic possibly would happen to them once they reached Jackson and entered the jail system there. So we were very concerned about them, and that's another reason we wanted to get into that jail facility while they were there, because we felt that the more individuals in there, the less likelihood someone would come up missing.
Mm-hmm.
in those systems. So that's what we were doing at that particular time. Of course, there were a lot of harrowing experiences in the field of voter registration that I could relate.
So what, you wanted to tell a story about that?
In voter registration, we were mandated to go to very small communities in the South to teach our voter registration processes to black individuals. And we did that. We would leave, one or two individuals would leave school on a Friday night or Saturday morning, hold those classes, and get back on campus sometime Sunday or Sunday night. We often didn't have as much time to study over the weekend as we needed, so what would happen once we returned? If we returned late Sunday night, we would be locked into the science building there to study until Monday morning, where we went and had breakfast and went back to class. One of my position with SNCC at that time was to pick up freedom riders that were arriving at Macomb, Mississippi. I believe that was on December 1st, 1961, where a schoolmate of mine, MacArthur Cotton, and I went there and attempted to meet with the chief of police and inform him about the arrival of the freedom riders and ask for his protection for all of us. Of course, he could not guarantee that. But anyway, as the freedom riders arrived, there was no one on the street, completely bare. As they departed from the bus, people came out of buildings everywhere with sticks, bats, and whatnot, in threatening situations. Freedom riders entered the bus station there, stayed there for approximately 40, came out into that mob. The mob, strangely enough, only pushed the Freedom Riders and my partner, MacArthur Cotton, a bit. They did beat up Look Magazine photographers there, but I just fortunately I didn't get a scratch that day. So there were a lot of experiences that we went through.
Yeah. We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that as we're coming into about our last 15 minutes. This is someone who is here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, in Champaign, actually, on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Armstrong, so much for your courage and keeping the faith and paving the way for the rest of us African-Americans, and to Dr. Arsenault for resurrecting and maintaining and keeping on with resurrecting the history. My question for Mr. Armstrong is, I know there was a lot of quiet support in the African-American communities for what was going on, but I also understand and know from personal experience that there was also some resistance. And how did you cope with African-Americans who chose to kind of castigate you and say you shouldn't be doing this, basically out of fear? I just wanted to know how you all managed to handle that, and particularly you're in Mississippi and you're riding with international people and white people, so that really had to kind of compound the fear factor there. Thank you for answering the question.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily so with me personally. I didn't feel that way because I knew from growing up in Mississippi that there were segments of black who said, you know, I can't help you, but eventually did end up doing so. They could not help us. They thought they could not help us because once they stepped out there and made it known that they were helping us, supporting us in any fashion, word or deed, they were subject to all kinds of atrocities, okay, beatings, loss of land, unable to support their families. So we knew this from the beginning. We did not have any animosity toward those people at all. In fact, even at Tougaloo College, most of the students there, their parents worked in some type of, I would say, state-supported jobs, okay? And many of the students at Tougaloo did not publicly support us because they knew if they did, their parents and their family would lose those jobs, lose possibly those homes and farms. So it was a different story for us who were in Mississippi and knew the real situation there.
I'll turn to Professor Arsenault. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about how it is within the larger civil rights movement. People looked at the Freedom Riders because there was controversy. People were not exactly sure that this was the right strategy.
That's exactly right. There was a great deal of opposition, particularly initially. The NAACP was not pleased at all, nor were most leaders of the national organizations. They were afraid that the Freedom Rides would actually set the movement back, that they would demonstrate exactly the opposite of what CORE was trying to demonstrate, that the Deep South was ready for nonviolent direct action, that they would very likely get themselves beaten up or even killed, and that it would and there would be mass arrests where a lot of the movement's precious financial resources would be spent on bond money and arraignments, and so they were not pleased at all. The public face was more apathetic than anything else, and it's only when the Freedom Riders were attacked in Birmingham and particularly in Montgomery on May 20th and 21st that the movement decided that they had to rally around the Freedom Riders, that even despite the differences in philosophy and strategy, the Freedom Rides were a reality and everyone had to rally around. And so that was a very important moment in the crystallization of the civil rights struggle as a national movement. People really did come together, and despite their misgivings, they supported the Freedom Rides, even in the face of continuing opposition from most Americans who did not want to support any kind of disruption of the civic order.
Just a little bit ago, Mr. Armstrong was talking about how he and other students were watching the coverage of the attacks on the Freedom Riders and were really thinking that they wanted to be there, they wanted to support them, and he said something about they really wanted to fill up the jails. And that is, maybe you can talk some more about that. First of all, Professor Arsenault, you can talk a little bit more about that, and maybe then Mr. Armstrong can as well, because this was also part of the strategy. They were interested in getting arrested and being sent to jail, and in fact, they went as far as if there was some opportunity for them to bail out, they wouldn't. Their idea was to fill up the jails, to jam up the system as much as they possibly could.
That's right. They were CORE particularly, and also the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, were deeply committed to a jail no bail policy. They wanted to follow the Gandhian tradition of filling the jails, and this was quite a radical change, which began actually in Rock Hill, South Carolina, in 1961. Southern jails were pretty scary places, and for most. Civil rights activists prior to this time, it was you wanted to get out as fast as you could, so it was a very daring strategy to reverse that tradition and to stay in jail, and it was again controversial not only in the kind of national populace but within the movement itself. Thurgood Marshall made a famous speech once at Fisk University where he said, if you can get out of jail, get out. And so people like Thurgood Marshall even had to be won over to this jail no bail strategy.
Well, Mr. Armstrong, maybe you can talk about how it is that you and other people thought about the prospect to going to jail. You must have known or had some pretty good idea what that would have been like.
Oh, yes. I knew people who had been in there before. And any conversation with them, you'd get the urge to stay out of that place. As far as the jail no bail situation, I think that was something that was, in fact, near the date that I was arrested, June 21st, 61, that was something that was actually being worked out by the attorneys who were representing the Freedom Riders. And, of course, most of those were NAACP attorneys, national and local. Trying to determine how each individual was going to plea to better affect the determination of the various organizations involved. I think the first gentleman that had the appeal trial, he pleaded not guilty. I think the next two or three pleaded no contest. My trial, I think I was about the fifth or seventh one. It was suggested that we plead not guilty, period. And so once they got that all kind of worked out legally, then we really pushed for jail no bail. A situation. The jails in Mississippi were terrible places to be, especially Parchman. I didn't go to Parchman. I was bailed out of jail by the president of Bidel of Tougaloo College shortly after I got in there. But many of the Freedom Riders did have very bad experiences in Parchman, State Penitentiary.
The Mississippi State Penitentiary, known as Parchman Farm. Maybe Professor Arsenault, you can talk a little bit more about what happened to people who went there.
To Parchman.
To Parchman, yeah.
Well, that was the ultimate strategy of the white supremacists in Mississippi, Governor Ross Barnett and Senator James O. Eastland. They thought they could intimidate the Freedom Riders in the kind of traditional way of not sending them just to a county jail or a city jail, but to a real prison. In fact, the scariest prison in the South. And they thought that this would break the back of the Freedom Rides, that these young students would be terrified and they'd go back to their parents, they'd go back to class. And of course, it had exactly the opposite effect. In the Gandhian tradition of seeking unmerited suffering. The parchment experience bonded the Freedom Riders to the movement and to each other, and created a larger group of what became the shock troops of the civil rights movement for the rest of the decade. They turned Parchment Prison not only into a civil rights protest site, but into a kind of university of nonviolence. And the more the prison officials tried to intimidate them and make them uncomfortable, the deeper their commitment. As Congressman John Lewis has said on a number of occasions, the people who went to Parchment Prison were never the same again. They became the nonviolent warriors that would lead the movement in the years to come, and Parchment had a lot to do with that.
So, Mr. Armstrong, when the president of your college came to bail you out, what did he say?
Actually, he was a great supporter of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. Tupelo College was a private institution at that time and was not really under the laws of the state, per se, in terms of, you know, its actions and how it operated as an institution. So Tupelo was, you know, in an oasis in the midst of a turbulent sea of hatred. At Tupelo, you were at home. That was the only safe place in Mississippi, you felt. So what he did, you know, was not beyond the realm of ordinary for him, okay? Mm-hmm. Many times, if you notice the famous sit-in demonstration at Woolworth store in Jackson there, at the counter, at the very far end, sitting in a seat, is the president of Tupelo College.
We're coming down to, we have a couple of minutes left. Again, I'll go back here to Professor Arsenault. You can talk a little bit about how the presidential administration, the Kennedy administration, responded to this. Because I think, again, it's part of the context to remind folks that certainly when John Kennedy was elected president, civil rights was not the thing that it was the top of his issue. I'm not even sure it was on his issues at all. He was worried about the Cold War. He wasn't worried about civil rights. And for him, he thought that this was a distraction, and he didn't particularly appreciate what the Freedom Riders were doing.
The Kennedys brothers, both of them, but particularly President John Kennedy, they were not amused at all by the Freedom Rides. They wanted to get those kids off those buses because President Kennedy was about to have his first summit meeting in Vienna with Nikita Khrushchev, and he wanted to represent the free world in this sort of struggle for the hearts and minds of the third world at that time. And the news stories and the photographs of burned buses and of the attempt to burn people to death just for the attempt to sit on the front of a bus made Americans look terrible in the eyes of the world. We came off as contemptible hypocrites trying to spread freedom and democracy to the rest of the world while we denied it to our own citizens. So the Kennedys were desperate to get this crisis over with, even though I think personally they had certainly some sympathy for the Freedom Riders. They didn't sympathize with their tactics, but they certainly sympathized with their goals. But they were tied politically to white segregationists in the South, who were in some ways the backbone of the Democratic Party at that time, and so they felt they had to go very, very slowly. They were very, very timid, and so the Freedom Rides educated them in 1961, and it caused a significant shift of the Kennedy administration and the federal government towards an active involvement in civil rights. But it was a lesson that had to be reinforced over and over again. There was a tendency to backslide in 1962 and even 1963. Mm-hmm. Before the Kennedys finally came to initiate a full-fledged public accommodations law that was introduced, of course, in the months before President Kennedy was assassinated. But without the Freedom Rides, I don't think the Kennedys ever would have gotten there. Certainly, they wouldn't have gotten there in 1963. So it works in an extraordinary change in their public posture relative to civil rights.
That's here again. I'll turn back to Mr. Armstrong. That just Professor Arsenault really made the point I was going to ask you to comment on it. Whether you think that without the Freedom Rides, that the administration would have then taken the actions that they did. Without that pressure on the administration, do you think that they would have done what they did?
If you're asking that to me,
yes,
I know that, well, the Freedom Riders definitely put the pressure on them and is the reason that they acted as they did. Freedom Riders, you have to understand, even in Mississippi, they open up that closed society. The educational system, they open that up. They open up the political process. And they made unheard of changes in Mississippi tight control caste system. So they did an awful lot to make Mississippi and this a country a better place to be.
Well, maybe I could just, as a way of finishing up, I'll ask you, Mr. Armstrong, can you talk a little bit about how it is that the experience of being involved in this, what it did for you, how it changed your life?
It fortified my commitment to mankind, I guess I would say, humankind. I was raised up in a family who was taught to respect the rights of others, no matter who they might be. The whole Freedom Ride and Civil Rights Movement process fortified that position. It also increased my dedication to the work that I wanted to do, and that is, free up all blacks anywhere in the country. So I was just doing what I thought I could do, and it was something that I would wanted to do, not just wanted to do, felt that I had to do. So that's what it was for me, being a member of the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. We want to thank our guests, Thomas M. Armstrong. He's a veteran of the early 60s Civil Rights Movement in his native Mississippi, now lives in Chicago. If you'd like to read some of his experiences, you can seek out his book, Autobiography of a Freedom Rider. Mr. Armstrong, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Raymond Arsenault. He's John Hope Franklin, professor of Southern History at University of South Florida, is the author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice, published by the Oxford University Press. Now out on paper, it's a companion edition to the American Experience documentary Freedom Riders that will be airing on our station, WYLL-TV, on Monday, May 16th. 8 o'clock in the evening. So we hope that you will see the documentary. You can read that book. Professor Arsenault, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.